That's Robbie Williams channeling James Bond in a song called Millennium, and I felt it seemed appropriate for the journey we're about to take with spies, high-tech, surveillance, plot twists, and a lot more. Imagine if you had a set of clothes that made you invisible. How would you use that technology? Would you pay visits to bank vaults and jewelry stores? Maybe play some pranks on loved ones? Spy on your neighbors? Mess with people's minds? Now imagine that technology in the hands of secret agencies, intelligence groups, or maybe corporate entities in the black world. Imagine what kind of mischief they could get into, the mind games they could play on us as they tested and perfected the technology. On the Coast website tonight, we posted a story about new breakthroughs in invisibility technology. This is not far-flung futuristic stuff. This is going on now, announced by private companies and researchers. And you have to figure, if they're talking about it in open-source forums, companies, how far along are the spooks of the black world, the spies, those who operate in that netherworld that we now know as the surveillance state, which is, we believe, omnipresent, right there over your shoulder, reading every email, listening to every phone call. I mean, invisibility could take that to a whole different level. Tonight, the stories of a couple of people who stumbled into this world, came face to face with the technology, and paid a price for it, thought they might be going crazy. Then they found out the startling truths that it's all too real, just how far it may have gone. It's very spooky stuff, very disturbing, as described in the book Camellio, subtitled A Strange But True Story of Invisible Spies, Heroin Addiction, and Homeland Security by Robert Guffey. In a moment, Robert Guffey here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Robert Guffey is a lecturer in the Department of English at Cal State University Long Beach, a graduate of the famed Clarion Writers Workshop in Seattle, author of a collection of novellas entitled Spies and Saucers. Sounds like a book we need to talk about. His first book of nonfiction, Cryptoschatology, Conspiracy Theory as Art Form, came out in 2012. The new book is Camellio, A Strange But True Story of Invisible Spies, Heroin Addiction, and Homeland Security. Welcome to the program, Robert Guffey. Good to have you here.
Hello. I'm honored to be on.
Man, I've finished the book today. It is a wild ride. And it's right there in the title, in the subtitle, True Story. It is a true story, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I've noticed in some of the book reviews, people will wonder aloud, you know, I really love the book. It moves along like a screenplay, like a thriller. Is it really true? I think people are so used to being lied to that when you label something as a true story, they assume you're doing some sort of trick or some sort of postmodern ironic experiment or something. No, it's exactly what it says it is. It's absolutely a true story.
Well, I figure what we'd do is in this hour, we sort of take the long, strange trip, and you tell me about the series of events that you and your friend Dion experienced for yourselves. And then in the next hour, we're going to get into this confrontation, not really a confrontation, but a sit down you have with the guy who really let us know that is real, and the guy, and where it started. So let's start with this. Let's start with Dion. I mean, because I've already got some emails from people who say, all right, look, it's a heroin addict. Are you going to interview a heroin addict? And no, we're interviewing the author who's written about it. But Dion, your friend, is a principal source for this story, and he is an addict. So it makes you wonder, is this hallucinations or tremors? Is his mind messed up, or is this really true stuff?
Okay, let me address that. For much of his life, well, quite frankly, he's probably been a methadone addict longer than he's been a heroin addict, but that's probably true of every heroin addict in the United States. They get addicted to methadone trying to get off the heroin. But as you know, as I'm sure you know, heroin is not a hallucinogen.
Right.
Not like LSD or mescaline or something like that. I've known Damien. I call him Dion Fuller in the book. His real name is Damien. He's told me he didn't mind if I said his real name.
Okay.
I changed all the names in the book except for those people who were public figures. And I've known Damien since I met him on my 16th birthday, so I know him very well. It all started in summer of 2003. I remember the day. It was July 12th. I remember that because that was also the day I was being initiated into the third degree of Freemasonry, And I called Damien to tell him that I was okay, they hadn't chopped my head off or something. And he wasn't there. And I left a message, and he didn't call back. He didn't call back that day or the next day or the next day. And 7 days went by without him calling, which was unusual. When he finally did call back, he told me that he just got out of jail and told me this strange story. Because he was involved in the drug world there in Pacific Beach in San Diego, house had become a kind of a 24/7 party house, and people were coming in and out all the time. And one of those people was this kid named Lee. Or he said his name was Lee. Later on, the authorities told us his real name was Doyle, so I don't know what his real name was. It was either Lee or Doyle. He had gone AWOL from Camp Pendleton, but my friend Damien did not know this. And the kid asked if he could crash at his apartment, and Damien said fine. He didn't realize that not only had he gone AWOL from Camp Pendleton, but he had taken with him a DOD laptop computer, a 9mm pistol taken off the body of a dead Iraqi general, 23 pairs of high-tech night vision goggles, and a truck. I don't know how he was able to get all that stuff off of Camp Pendleton, but he did. I suspect it's probably easier than we might imagine. And one day, in the midst of this party, this kid, Lee, opens the laptop computer, and the DOD symbol appears on the screen. And immediately, Damien says, "Get that LoJack stuff out of here and get out of here." And the kid says, "Don't worry about it. They can't track this." And then about 3 minutes later, there's an officious knock at the door. Damien opens it, and there is a woman who identifies herself as, in the book, I call her Lita Johnson, but that's not her name. And behind her are two officious-looking gentlemen. She identifies herself as an officer of the NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigative Services. She says she wants to search the apartment. And Damien's dad was a narcotics cop. Damien's very familiar with the law. And he said, "No, you have to come back with a warrant." She said, "I'll be right back." So Damien closes the door. He turns to everyone at the party and says, "Take your stuff and go out the back." And everyone at the party immediately throws all their drugs on the floor, and they go out the back. And now, about 2 minutes later, Lita Johnson comes back with her warrant, and the NCIS search the place. There's drugs everywhere. They don't care about that. All they seem to care about are these night vision goggles. For some reason, that was the thing that most obsessed them. That's what they wanted. They arrest Damien. They arrest the kid who had gone AWOL. They take him to jail in downtown San Diego, and they give Damien the Abu Ghraib treatment for about a week. And they're constantly grilling him. You know, they're accusing him of wanting to sell the stolen equipment to Al-Qaeda, and et cetera. And Damien, meanwhile, is trapped in this Kafkaesque nightmare and trying to explain to them, "No, I only knew him for a couple of days." And they didn't want to believe that. Why would you let someone stay at your apartment if you'd only known them for a couple of days? Well, because that's what he did.
Did you say in the book that the cops were also there along with NCIS?
Yes. The NCIS and the local police both showed up. And, in fact, according to Damien, they were very like Keystone cops. They weren't working together. They were constantly bouncing off each other and kind of arguing with each other. So I don't know exactly how that came about. Both the police and the NCIS were there grilling Damien in jail. And they wanted him eventually to testify against this kid, Lee. And he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't cooperate. He wouldn't give them any information. Because he didn't want to. He didn't feel that he needed to, and he had nothing to do with this, right?
He has like a drug guy's code or something. He doesn't want to snitch on somebody.
Well, that was it, and there were also other people involved there that he didn't want to get into trouble. And so that was part of it. And the simple fact that he didn't do anything wrong, you know, and he's not the most cooperative person in the world in the first place.
So NCIS is the one doing the grilling. He's in jail. He's behind bars, but he was not actually charged with anything, even though there were drugs all over the place, right?
Exactly. They didn't care about the drugs at all. And after about a week, they let him go. And he thought, oh, obviously they've come to their senses. They realize this was all a big mistake, and they've let me go. He calls me, and he tells me this whole story. And I think, well, that's very strange. He calls me back a couple of days later to say that things have gotten stranger. He claims that people are now following him all around Pacific Beach, all around San Diego. And by I mean following him, I mean 7-9 people following him into a 7-Eleven, like a parade of jarhead-looking guys following him into a 7-Eleven. Following him back out, going into the Mexican restaurant down the street, sitting down, interrupting his daily routine in bizarre ways, making themselves, it wasn't like a spy hiding behind a newspaper. They wanted themselves to be seen by him. They wanted him to see them, and they wanted him to feel disturbed, discombobulated, paranoid. And he calls me, he's telling me all this. Now, at first I thought, okay, I could see if maybe one or two people were following him. It seemed improbable that a whole parade of people were following him. So at first, I have to admit, I wondered if he was suffering from some sort of drug-induced paranoia or something like that. But then he said that these vehicles were parked outside his house, and that these vehicles were following him all around. I told him, we'll take photographs of them, of the license plate numbers, and send them to me. And it just so happens I knew a guy who worked at the DMV in Seattle. So I collected all these license plate numbers and sent them to my friend at the DMV. And he actually ran all the plates, and what was fascinating was that none of them officially existed. Now, if Damien was being paranoid, they would have been traceable to a specific person who lived in San Diego and was driving this car. But no, none of them officially existed, which suggested to me that they were government vehicles. I can't think of any other reason why they wouldn't be in the system. So it was each one. It wasn't just like one of them. None of them officially existed. So at that point, I began to think maybe he's not being just paranoid.
Yeah, well, go back for a second, because, you know, the significance of him coming up with all these license plates that are not real, I mean, what are the chances that you can come up with something? I mean, they're actually, you've got them listed in the book and just the descriptions of the cars, that he could actually stumble on license plates that don't exist.
Right, and he photographed them, too.
Yeah.
Then, after that point, that's when things started to step up a bit, and they began, as he described it, bombarding him with hallucinations. I don't know how else to describe it. He would look out the window, and the scenery that would always be there was no longer there. Now it looked like some sort of alien world with three moons in the sky. I describe it as like a Boris Vallejo painting outside the window. You know, he'd open the door, and it's the same scenery that had always been there. People would come over and ask him, is the room getting larger? It began to seem as if his apartment was turning into Doctor Who's TARDIS. You'd go in and the room would look larger than it should from the outside, or would look smaller. It wasn't just him seeing this, other people were also seeing it. And then he began to report that there were people in his house that he couldn't see that were interacting with him, that were moving things around, that were pushing him, physically interacting with him in that way, watching him while in the room with him, but he couldn't see them, except for specific occasions. And on one occasion, he was in the bathroom, and he turned the medicine cabinet mirror. He opened the medicine cabinet, and as the mirror was in motion, as he was opening it, he could see the person behind him, but only as it was in motion. And then the other time that he could see something was when occasionally he would see these kind of dots in the air, like almost like auras, like you would see if you suffered from an intense migraine headache. But it sort of imagine that in the outline of like a person, a small person. And things like this began to happen more and more, and he would call me in a panic, acting in ways that he's a pretty fearless person, you know, and he's calling me, telling me about the fact that they had projected a shadow of a hand on the wall of his bedroom with a gun in it, and the hand would tilt down and point at him. One time he saw this kind of black amorphous energy sort of crawling around the carpet on the floor that filled up his leather jacket, and then the leather jacket began to move across the floor. Things like this began to grow more and more intense, and then the neighbors who had lived there for a long time began to move out one by one and were replaced by new neighbors who seemed decidedly unfriendly. The landlord started to act very strange towards him, as if the landlord just wanted him to leave. And then in the midst of all this, Lita Johnson, the NCIS woman, would show up at his door and say, "Have you changed your mind? Would you like to cooperate with us now?" And he would say no, and then she would say, "Oh, okay," and then she and the two guys who were with her would get back in the car, they'd drive away, and then it would start all over again. Like, the second they drove away, all this crazy stuff would start happening again.
But you're living where? You're living in somewhere else while this is going on. He's telling you this stuff over the phone as it's unfolding, right?
Right. I was living in Torrance, and he was in Pacific Beach. Now, you might then say, well, you yourself didn't see this. How do you know this was happening? Maybe he imagined this NCIS woman. Well, he gave me her phone number, and because she had given it to him, and she said, if you ever change your mind and you want to cooperate and give us information that we want, this is my phone number. So at one point, I chose to call her, and I have the transcription of that phone call in the book, and she wasn't happy to be receiving a phone call from me. That was number one. She seemed very uncomfortable when I asked her directly if she or people she was working for were following Damien around. She said she started using kind of CYA kind of language. Oh, no one that is working for my agency is currently following your friend. Carefully worded sentences like that. And the phone call didn't go well. She basically implied that he was crazy and just wanted to end the conversation as quickly as possible.
So according to Damien, though, he's had some meetings with her in between the time you eventually called her, but in between then, he met with her a few times.
Oh, yes. There was one incident where they kept him up all night. I was on the phone with him and actually heard he was describing, like, invisible bullets coming through the wall and shattering
his window or something.
His window and things that were, you know, the tchotchkes that were sitting on the shelf, and I actually heard these things exploding, and I heard Damien, he was extremely frightened, and as I say, not usually very frightened very easily. I mean, it was almost like poltergeist activity, you know, that type of thing, though clearly that's not what it was. And they kept him up all night, but he was scheduled to go meet this woman and her superior at a bagel shop on Garnet Avenue, and he comes up with the quote brilliant unquote plan that he would propose to them that maybe if he volunteered to work with them to try to get these things back, that maybe they would back off a bit. And when he suggested this, I said, well, I don't think that's going to work, because the way they're going to interpret that is that they're going to think that you had these things all along, these night vision goggles, and that now you want money for it.
All right, Robert, we're going to pick up the story on the other side here. We're talking with Robert Guffey about Camellio, his book. Jethro Tull takes us into the break on Coast to Coast AM. The video, the music video for this song is really interesting. Shows a time when humans exist only in museums. Robots rule the earth. It's Paul McCartney. The song is called Appreciate. Pretty good tune. We're talking to Robert Guffey about his amazing book, Camellia, a strange but true story about invisible spies, heroin addiction, and homeland security. Still to come, the other adventures that both Robert and his friend Damien experienced, things that they saw, and the scientists they met who confirmed a lot of their worst suspicions. A lot more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Just to recap a little bit, the story starts in 2003. A guy named Lee, who was AWOL from Camp Pendleton, shows up at a drug house and crashes for a couple of days. Unbeknownst to this guy named Damien, who has the apartment, Lee had was not only AWOL, but he had stolen a truck, a Department of Defense computer, and at least 23 pairs of high-tech night vision goggles, and the NCIS comes looking for them, and then all hell breaks loose for this guy Damien, known in the book as Dion. But tell me this, Robert, had you ever studied group stalking? You'd ever looked at the idea of electronic harassment before your friends started telling you this story?
I had never heard of gang stalking, and in fact, that term didn't even exist in 2003. It's only come into existence since then. At the time, the closest thing I could find to it was something called, they were calling it street theater, just as a way of trying to describe this kind of odd theatricality element that was to the surveillance. I was familiar with electronic harassment, and I was very familiar with mind control programs because I was a friend of Walter Boart, who wrote Operation Mind Control, which was like the seminal book on mind control, published in 1978. And Walter and I, we collaborated on the screenplay together. I knew him very well. He passed away in 2007. So oddly enough, I was very prepared for the kind of electronic harassment stuff. I could wrap my mind around that. The whole gang stalking aspect was completely new to me. And I only learned about it as I was sort of digging around on the internet trying to figure out what this was. And I found a website that was run by a woman named Raven One, and her website has since completely disappeared. And I don't know what happened to her, but she had some very cogent descriptions of the entire technique that they would use to basically drive a particular person crazy. Essentially, is the main point of it.
And does that seem like what they were trying to do to your friend? I mean, because as you describe in the book, some of these encounters he had with these people, they're following him. They're not even trying to hide it. It becomes almost comical and ridiculous, the methods that they use.
There's definitely an absurd quality to it all. And the purpose of it is definitely to target a specific individual and drive them over the deep end by making them think that they're going crazy. And I think that they might even target people who are heroin addicts, who are drug addicts, who are on the margins of society, because most of the times those people, who's going to believe them? If you're a drug addict and you start going around saying, people are following me, they're shooting acoustic bullets through my window, who's going to believe that? And they had no way of knowing that this guy had a friend who was a professor who knew Walter Boart, who wrote Operation Mind Control, and in fact, I had already been writing for Paranoia Magazine. I'd written several articles for Paranoia Magazine going back to 1996. So I was kind of, in a way, prepared for it. And even though I was already prepared for it, still, as I said, my initial reaction when he told me about being followed by a group of people was that maybe he was suffering from some sort of drug-induced paranoia. I mean,
was there one event other than that call to Lita Johnson, NCIS, was there an event that sort of put it beyond the idea that it was just a delusion on his part?
Oh, well, I mentioned the license plates. That was one.
Yeah.
The talking to her, that definitely, because her whole attitude was just suspicious. And also, it just occurred to me that I should mention the food fight with the feds.
Sure.
Because this actually leads into the conversation that he later has with Lita Johnson on Garnet Avenue. One day he was in the kitchen and he was making lunch, and there were these two guys who had been posted outside, right outside the fence, outside his window, and they'd been there for a while, and they would come by, they'd make weird noises, they would say things about him, so he's in the middle of making lunch, and as they're doing this, he starts taking like flour, peanut butter, tapioca, Jell-O, he starts mixing all this stuff together into this weird goop. And then in the middle of it, runs outside and then tosses it over the fence, and it hits these two jarheads, and now they're covered in this like green slime, and they run away screaming into the Vons parking lot next door. Now, I mentioned that because when Lita Johnson wanted him to meet her and her superior at this bagel shop on Garnet Avenue, Damien went there with this proposal that maybe he could help them, like, retrieve the goggles in some way. And they didn't take kindly to that at all. They just wanted, they bought him a bagel and an orange juice. That was, I guess, their way of bribing him. And they wanted him to just cooperate and to tell them where these goggles were. And the conversation didn't end well. Eventually it just ended with Damien accusing them of being fascist, the superior, Lita's superior, just his face grew red and he banged his hairy fist into the table and said, "Enjoy the orange juice and the bagel." And then he and Lita Johnson like walked out. But in the middle of that conversation, Damien actually said to them, "Listen, I'm just tired of all this. I want it to all end. I'm tired of having food fights with the feds." And when he said that, Lita Johnson smiled and she said, "Oh, yes, that made all of us laugh," which was the only one of two times when they actually broke script and admitted that all of this was happening, because in every other circumstance, they would pretend like this wasn't happening, this is something you're imagining. It's like the film Gaslight. It's like they were gaslighting him, you know.
Yeah, so he's saying to her all along in these conversations, "Hey, make this go away. What can I do to make this stop?" And she's basically pretending, "I don't know what you're talking about," but parsing the language like, my agency is not doing any surveillance of you, without saying someone else might be.
Exactly. And in fact, the conversation, there's something she said that I thought was very revealing during that conversation. She started talking to him about how she had grown up in San Diego and in Pacific Beach, and how this used to be a beautiful area, but now there are these drug addicts and these heathens running around, and we really need to clean it up. And Damien kind of sometimes has a kind of Candide-like quality about him, where if you're insulting them, he's like not aware of it. So even though she was actually referring to him when she was talking about drug addicts and scumbags and we need to clear these people out, she's talking about him. You know,
yeah.
It goes right over his head, and this just frustrates them more and more. But I thought that was very revealing, that this was more than just they want these goggles back. I mean, they were operating out of a kind of weird righteousness.
So at some point they wanted, I mean, obviously they wanted the goggles back, and we'll get into maybe other reasons why that might be true, not just regular night vision goggles, which are valuable enough, but at some point you think that maybe they just saw this as an opportunity to test this technology and let's go ahead and burn up the budget and drive this guy crazy.
I think what happened was when he refused to cooperate, he pissed somebody off. He pissed her off, and he went on, quote, the list. And with the whole gang stalking phenomenon, for some people, it's seemingly random. They have no idea why it starts. No idea. It just starts one day, and of course they think they're going crazy. In Damien's case, we can kind of pinpoint, well, it's pretty clear how this started and who started it, you know. So after the conversation with them goes south on Garnet Avenue, everything kind of spirals down from there. Everything, the harassment gets worse. He starts experiencing great weight loss, hair loss, metallic taste in his mouth, which is I remember Walter Boart telling me that was a sign of basically induced, you know, electronic harassment. And it got so bad that at one point I volunteered. He had met this beachcomber on the beach who had a van that he was selling, And I actually, without telling Damien, wired him via Western Union $500 to buy this van from this beachcomber so that he could just leave town. Because we figured, well, if he leaves town, it'll stop.
It's like you say in the book, it's like, you know, in haunted house stories, people will ask, well, why don't they just leave?
Right.
You know, why doesn't he call the cops?
And he did call the cops, and the cops came, and there was one particular incident where two cops came, a younger cop and an older cop, and it was very strange because the younger cop was very sympathetic to him and wanted to know more, and the older cop just kept acting like he was crazy, and it was almost as if the older cop knew what was going on and the younger cop didn't. I assume local law enforcement, at least some of them, must be aware that these things are going on. When I arranged to buy this van for Damien so he could leave, so he basically threw all of his stuff into the back of the van and took off. Now there are those haunted house cases, by the way, where they do leave the house and they move somewhere and it follows them. That's the situation. he gets into the van and he leaves, and immediately he's being followed by these, what he described as weird little drones that are following him around everywhere. Sometimes they're up close, sometimes they're way up in the sky, lights that would then descend and get closer. In fact, I recently read your book, Hunt for the Skinwalker, about the ranch in Utah, and I found weird parallels between the two situations.
I want to ask you about that. There's a couple of really specific incidents that I'm seeing in a new light, and we'll get to that in the next hour. But let's talk about his little road trip. It's not a little road trip. It's a massive road trip.
No.
And it follows him.
It takes him all around the country. He goes through Texas. He goes through, he's driving through Kansas at one point, and you had asked me before, why else did you think that this wasn't just a hallucination? Well, some of the strange phenomena was being verified by people he was meeting along the way. And there was one day I got this very strange phone call out of the blue. I pick up the phone, and it's this guy with a thick southern accent, like right out of Deliverance. And he says, "You Professor Guffey?" And I say, "Yeah." And he goes, "You know a guy named Damien?" And I go, "Yeah." And now I'm thinking, what's happening? Well, this guy proceeds to tell me that they just picked up Damien off the side of the road because his van broke down. And Damien had told them the entire story, what had happened up to this point, and they're freaked out, and they're calling me to confirm it, to see if any of this is true. As I'm talking to them and confirming it, and then some, they get extremely frightened, and they start telling me that they see this UFO thing coming down out of the sky and then descending towards their house. And as I'm talking to them on the phone, they're describing this, and they're extremely disturbed. And I convinced them after that to help Damien put gas in his van, and they did. And he drove all the way to Winona, Kansas. In Winona, Kansas, there's like 100 people living in Winona, Kansas. And apparently, if there's anyone getting gang stalked out there, move to Winona, Kansas, because apparently if there's only 100 people living in the town, they can't get away with this stuff, because you would suddenly notice, if there's only 100 people in the town, you would suddenly notice if a parade of strangers came into town following some guy in a black van. Also, people in Winona, Kansas own guns, so you don't want to be running around in your invisibility suits when there's a bunch of people with guns around. I don't think the invisibility suits prevent you from being shot.
Well, there's a note for anybody suffering from gang stalking. Move to a tiny little town. I want to back up. Now, back when Damien was still in his apartment,
yeah,
we didn't use this term, but he started talking to you about invisible midgets, and I can only imagine the first time he uses that term, how crazy you must have thought him being. Invisible midgets, that sounds ridiculous.
In fact, the first sentence of the book is, "My friend Dion first told me about the invisible midgets in the summer of 2003, which I think should get an award for best first line of a book in 2015. we used the term, he started using the term invisible midgets, and we started then using it over and over again, and it became a kind of comedic mantra. It was a kind of just darkly humorous thing to kind of break the tension of all of this. But there is sort of some truth to it, because what he perceived was the moments when he did see them, were that they were small, thin, agile people wearing these things, which kind of makes sense. If you want to give someone an invisibility suit and you want to send them into a covert situation, or you want to test out that suit and see how it works in real time in an unpredictable situation, why not send in people who are small, thin, and agile? So they're little people wearing these things, according to Damien, and that makes sense to me. And so,
let me
yeah.
ask you this part. This guy Lee, or Doyle, who was the impetus for this whole thing, who the guy who was AWOL, who stole the night vision goggles, who stole the truck and the computer, he was taken into custody at the same time as your friend Damien. What happened to him?
I desperately attempted to find that out. I would love to know. If there's anyone listening who knows who that guy is, please contact me.
But as far as you know, they never got back their night vision goggles, or if they got them out of this guy, it still didn't get them off of Damien's trail.
Exactly. As far as I know, they never got them back. I assume they didn't get them back.
You found a news article about a theft or something from Camp Pendleton around the same time, oddly enough, an Iraqi gun.
Yes, that was another odd sort of confirmation. Someone had lost a gun, and this guy had been accused of stealing it. And he says in the article, I feel like my whole life has been turned upside down. The guy, I think, said that his whole kind of career was his military career was on the line because they were accusing him of stealing this gun that had gone missing, and it was around the same time period that this guy went AWOL with the gun, So I don't know if they just pinned it on this other guy. I don't think they ever retrieved the gun because, as far as I know, Damien never described that the gun was there.
What jumped out at me was in this newspaper article, this guy says he's falsely accused of stealing this thing. They assert that he told them that it was a family heirloom. It's been in his family 20 years. He says, I never made these kind of statements. It was like people were making stuff up on his behalf. That's why I thought it kind of fit your scenario.
Right. That's true as well. Yes.
And we should point out, I mean, Camp Pendleton, Southern California, there's a heck of a lot of pretty touchy, cutting-edge, military, spooky research that goes on in these places.
It was amazing. I was not really aware of how militarized San Diego is until all of this, because as I started looking into it, SAIC, which I think is a corporation that is at the heart of this, was only about within running distance of Damien's apartment, and other corporations like this were all around that area, and SAIC has since left that area, but they were there until I think at least 2008, and I went there in 2008 to look at the SAIC headquarters that was there at the time, and I was amused to see that they were located right across the street from the Whaley House, which is notorious for being the most haunted house in California. Huh. And it just suddenly occurred to me that wouldn't it be interesting if maybe they built the headquarters there for some geographical purpose? Maybe there was something about that location that they built it there, but that's just a parenthetical speculation on my part.
We'll come back to SAIC and some of the projects and research that they do, because I should point out one of the things that caught my attention about it is they had the contract to run Area 51 for a while and were very active here in Nevada in a variety of different kinds of pursuits, and the Nevada test site, and that's a big company. It's a gigantic company and a key defense contractor with all kinds of heavy-duty clearances. If anybody was doing research into this kind of thing, it would be SAIC. We're talking with Robert Guffey about his book, Camellio, A Strange But True Story About Invisible Spies, etc. Coming up in the next hour, we're going to meet the scientists who confirm many of his worst fears. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast.